infertility, treatments, and support. In her recent best-selling book, former First Lady Michelle Obama revealed that she struggled with fertility, had a miscarriage, and conceived her girls with the help of IVF, in vitro fertilization. She has since discussed her story and the pain it caused her openly on national television programs and on the lecture circuit. Michelle Obama is far from alone. The CDC estimates that 1 in 10 American women has trouble getting pregnant. Millions of couples turn to different treatments, from acupuncture to IVF, in hopes of conceiving a baby. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll learn about the latest methods for treating infertility. We'll discuss the new emphasis on considering infertility a disease and the shame and stigma many women feel when struggling with it. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Sometimes the process of creating a family does not go as planned. Infertility can be surprising, frustrating, and emotional, especially for people who had planned and expected to be able to conceive a baby. Today, we'll learn about infertility, from causes to treatments to new approaches. Joining me in the studio, Dr. Ben Lannan. He is a reproductive endocrinologist at Boston IVF and a clinical instructor at Maine Medical Center. Catherine Alexander Anderson is a doctor of acupuncture and Chinese medicine, and she is the founder and clinical director of Rhythms, offering reproductive care. She's also the president of the American Board of Oriental Reproductive Medicine. And Elise Corbett is a licensed psychologist with Bella Vita Counseling in Portland, with a special interest in reproductive health counseling. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you or someone you know been dealing with fertility issues? Do you have questions about new treatment options? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here today. Ben, I'm going to start with you. What is the basic definition of infertility?
Thanks again for having us. The basic definition starts with just people trying to get pregnant. So for the average couple, we tell them to try for about a year, and if they're not getting pregnant, that's a sign that there may be some underlying problems. And as couples get older, so for women in their and couples in their middle 30s and beyond, we might say after 6 months to check in with a physician or someone to look into it.
What are some of the more common causes of infertility?
It's a pretty broad range, but we kind of break it into issues that are going on with the female reproductive system, the male reproductive system, and then there's kind of a big group of what we call unexplained infertility, which is where we do a bunch of testing and don't really find anything specific, but it mostly has to do with the fact that our testing is limited to see lots of the different parts of the system. So.
Okay, and I've read that it's about a third the woman, the third the man, and a third we don't know.
Yeah, if you ask couples, you know, they never get the exact percentages right, and people often assign more blame to themselves or to their partner. But if you really break it down across the groups, it breaks about a third into each of those categories.
Catherine, you offer alternative approaches to health. Can you describe what you do for people worried about infertility?
Well, I specialize more in natural approaches. I use acupuncture and Chinese medicine. And, you know, in Chinese medicine, we look at the holistic viewpoint. And so acupuncture, Chinese medicine, nutrition are the foundations, of that. But I also practice integratively. So I work frequently with Dr. Lannan. We work integratively, conjunctively to assess the patient. I'm trained in both Western reproductive medicine and Chinese reproductive medicine. So I'm looking at the patient you know, both sides to really see if we can impact helping them to conceive.
Does this represent something relatively new in medicine that you two will be working together?
I mean, for me, I would say this is what most forms of modern medicine we hope for, where we have a good complementary combination of Eastern and Western medicine. I think some specialties lend themselves more to this kind of interaction. And, you know, I think I would say for myself, Catherine and I have had a good working relationship, and many reproductive endocrinologists around the country have partnered with Chinese medicine and acupuncture groups because of the synergies that exist.
All right. I want to bring you, Elise, into the conversation. You counsel people. Tell us about some of the situations that you've encountered with clients who are struggling with infertility.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm a hard office to visit. Well, I think all of our offices are probably hard to visit. But I think that ultimately my goal is to provide a space where people can come and experience the breadth of that psychological and emotional impact. It's not necessarily that anybody going through infertility would be assessed to have any more risk for psychological or emotional issues. It's just that they tend to come up because of the themes that infertility can bring out for them.
So it's harder than somebody might realize. If you haven't experienced this, you don't know how hard it can be.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are a lot of themes of powerlessness in this, you know, that a lot of the people that I see are people who feel like they can usually put A plus B together to make C. And this is just one of those things where you can't kind of will something different. You can't go learn more information and get better at it. And that's a new affront, I think, for people when they just don't know what else to do. And then add to that that we live in a culture that I think doesn't really understand fertility or infertility. They don't really understand grief. And I think people just feel really alone in this process and misunderstood.
Dr. Lannan, you're nodding. If someone has tried to conceive for more than a year and comes to your office, tell us what happens next. How do we look at infertility treatments? When do certain things? Do we start trying certain things? Just walk us through it.
Yeah, so the first step is engaging with somebody, and somebody might come through Catherine's office, they might come through mine. They might go through their primary care physician or other provider or gynecologist. But the first step is just a conversation, for me at least, and that is to just kind of normalize where people are in the whole experience. You know, after a year of trying, people are pretty frustrated and exasperated, as Elise was saying, at just kind of not knowing where to go next. And you can try really hard and not seem like you're making progress. So I try to do some normalization of that. And then really my next step is preliminary testing to see if we can identify an obvious cause. And that involves some laboratory studies and some investigation of sperm and the reproductive system for women to see if we can find an area where something isn't working. And then from there, we move on to the different treatment aspects.
And what are some of the variety of treatments? I know that IVF, in vitro fertilization, is something many people are familiar with. Is that the most common treatment, or are there others that are equally as common and effective?
Yeah, so IVF is required by a very small percentage of our patients, actually, and it depends on what the underlying cause is. But for some people, going through the testing and initial information, they may just keep trying on their own for a little bit longer, and many people will end up being successful. So it doesn't necessarily mean that because you've come in to see us that you have to do something invasive. Some couples will try procedures called intrauterine insemination, which is where we're delivering the sperm in a different way to try to facilitate the egg and sperm meeting. And then IVF is kind of the, not necessarily the end point, but a more invasive approach where we're actually taking more control of the system and getting the eggs and sperm together outside of the body.
All right. And I'll turn to you, Catherine. What would the experience be for somebody coming to you?
So if somebody comes into my office and they're trying to conceive, I'll look at them. You know, one of the first questions I'll ask them is, have they been to their OBGYN? Have they had any testing done? Have they been to see Dr. Lannan or another reproductive endocrinologist? And they'll say yes or no. Yes, I've had all these testing and everything's normal. And I say, okay, can I see what's normal? So oftentimes what's really interesting is I might see something when I look at the test results from a narrower standpoint and find that something's not really normal. And then I might refer them out at that point for more testing to Dr. Lannan. So, but from a Chinese medical standpoint, you know, I'm looking at every system and the way we diagnose is a little bit differently. But one of the main things that I do look at is their menstrual cycles and what's happening there. There's an ancient saying in Chinese medicine that we say nourish the soil before planting the seed. And it basically is, you know, get everything in order. What the way we view a menstrual cycle can tell us a lot about what's happening with someone's fertility.
I know, and I want you all to correct me if this is wrong, but I know there's a sense out there that stress is not good for trying to conceive a baby, and that this often becomes a snowball effect where people are feeling so stressed and so upset about their inability to conceive that perhaps that's not helping anything. Is that accurate?
I think in some ways, stress makes it more difficult to keep trying. If you think about humans throughout existence, people have reproduced under very stressful conditions. And so I think a lot of times people end up sort of feeling bad about the stress they have. And this is, you know, where I, you know, often refer people to someone like Elise to say, you know, you have to, people around you are saying, oh, you just need to relax. And, you know, it's, then people make it their fault that they're not getting pregnant because they're so stressed about it. But I don't think the stress is necessarily the cause of the fertility problem, but it might be compounding why people are having a hard time continuing.
Elise.
Yeah, I'm nodding pretty excessively here. I fully agree. I think that, one of the things that's so strong about Dr. Landon is how he's able to really see that kind of whole impact on people and that whole person explanation of where somebody's at. The stress theory, I think, is really hard because a lot of people come into my office and say, you know, if I just do this better or if I just relax in this way. And really, my conceptualization of that is that they're seeking power. They're trying to have something they can do to make things better. But the problem is that they shoulder themselves with so much responsibility to just be relaxed or to just take it easy. And I think those things really go hand in hand. And so the stress theory that that gets in the way of conception or being able to get pregnant, I think, does more harm than good in general.
And let me ask you about that, because we have so many people listening right now who may be thinking, oh, my goodness, have I said something? What would you advise loved ones who know somebody who either they know they're struggling with infertility or don't know? Maybe that somebody's been a couple for a long time. And, you know, what is the mother-in-law to say that's not when are you going to have a baby?
Sure. Yeah, I really appreciate you asking this question, because I think that, you know, loved ones really are well-intentioned and they care a lot. And it's hard to know what to say. I really liken it to a bereaved situation where I think we all really want to help. And similarly, are we feeling sort of powerless to know what to do when somebody's in a situation where they're trying to get pregnant and aren't having success? And so I think some of the best things to do are just to be quiet, actually, and just listen and just hold space for somebody to experience their emotion and talk through what's going on. I think non-judgmentally showing up, not feeling like you have to have the answers or to fix a problem. We have tremendous experts, as you're hearing from, who can help people through this medically and otherwise. And nobody, though, can replace mom or spouse or aunt or uncle or friend. Like, that's your special job. So just be mom or just be friend and just listen and let the experts really help people make the medical decisions on where to go next.
We're talking about infertility on Maine Calling. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. What are some of the newest treatments out? Not only things, Dr. Landon, that are available today, but might be available in the near future?
Yeah, I think we are continuing to work on ways to test embryos. So as part of the process of IVF, we make an embryo outside of the body. And one of the limitations over the last 40 years of doing this has been figuring out which embryos are going to turn into babies and which ones aren't. And so we're evolving newer technologies to test embryos for different things. We can test for genetic disorders. We can test for chromosomal disorders. And we're trying to figure out new ways to do that with less and less invasion of the embryo. You'll hear stuff in the media now about gene editing, which is actually very controversial right now. And it's a scientific technology where we can actually not only test an embryo for something, but we could replace a gene within that embryo. And that opens a whole scary list of things that no one is sure what to do with. But I think that's something that will be debated as we go forward in this profession of where do we draw the line, and, you know, fixing disease versus making designer babies has been a fear in this profession since it started 40 years ago.
What about freezing eggs, freezing ovarian tissue? That's sort of the cutting edge as well, right?
Yeah, freezing eggs is definitely happening now. And that's, I think, a really interesting option for a number of things. You know, people sort of hear about it, a lot of women who are in their early to middle 30s thinking about prolonging their fertility options and freezing eggs at their age so that they don't have to worry about their biological clock. But freezing for women who are undergoing chemotherapy for cancer is a new thing that we're doing, as well as particularly women who are transitioning for transgender reassignment surgery. They may freeze their eggs before undergoing those kind of procedures.
How long can an egg be frozen and still be viable?
The technology's gotten really good, and we sort of feel like it could last forever. There's a natural biological limit. So, you know, a woman who freezes her eggs at 30 is going to have a time point where she's going to want to have a child, and it's probably not 30 years later. But in theory, the eggs are and embryos are lasting a very long time in storage. So,
wow. Well, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Two Fat Cats, scratch baking with an emphasis on Maine desserts and pies in Portland and South Portland, and at twofatcatsbakery.com.
On the next Fresh Air.
When someone like R. Kelly gets in trouble, there's this knee-jerk instinct to protect him.
The documentary series Surviving R. Kelly features interviews with women who allege he sexually and physically abused them, and it examines how the music industry and fans protected him. We'll talk with executive producer Dream Hampton. Join us.
That's tonight at 7 here on Maine Public Radio. There are literally millions of podcasts out there. How do you find your next favorite or even get started in the first place? Well, Maine Public has a podcast shortlist that focuses entirely on podcasts created in Maine and provides easy access to a wide range of Maine's most informative, interactive, and entertaining podcasts. Do you have a Maine podcast that you really enjoy and would be a great addition to the podcast shortlist? Shoot us a note to shortlist@mainepublic.org. The Maine Public Podcast Shortlist is at mainepublic.org. Click on Podcast Shortlist under our radio tab.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Understanding Infertility. Joining me in the studio, Catherine Alexander Anderson, Doctor of Acupuncture and Chinese Medicine, and founder and clinical director of Rhythms, a reproductive acupuncture practice. Elise Corbett, psychologist with Bella Vita Counseling, with a focus on reproductive health, and Ben Lannan, a reproductive endocrinologist at Boston IVF. He is based in Maine. We invite you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining me now on the line is Elena LeBlanc Trident. She lives in Kennebunk and is now pregnant after undergoing fertility treatment. Elena, thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you for having me.
Can you share your story with us? I understand you had trouble conceiving.
I did. We did. I need to include my husband in this. We have been had been trying for about 2.5 years. We tried naturally for around 6 months, and then we visited my doctor, and we decided to go on some ovulation stimulants such as Clomid, which a lot of women have done. Unfortunately, we did not have success with 3 rounds of those drugs. So then we moved forward with 3, as Dr. Lannan already mentioned, intrauterine insemination, so IUIs. We did not have success with those, so then we knew we had to take that next step, and that's when we met Dr. Lannan, and I also met Catherine and started acupuncture to really get my body in the best shape possible, knowing what laid ahead.
So you are pregnant now. When are you due?
In June.
Oh, exciting. Can you talk a little bit about the emotional journey that you've been through?
It's a roller coaster, I'm not going to lie. I went into a very dark space, probably the summer of 2017. Everyone around me was getting pregnant, including my best friends. So that did not make it easy. I come from a very fertile family. This will be the 13th grandchild on my side. So I expected what was going to be easy, was not, and it just really kind of threw me for a loop. And my husband actually sat me down after I kind of had a mental breakdown, and he said, one, we just have to lay down some rules. This cannot take over our marriage. And then we had to come up with, and Catherine helped us with this actually, we had to just determine that we would be okay if this wasn't successful, that we would be okay moving forward just being the two of us. And once we realized those two things, I was much more positive, and we were like, okay, let's do this. If it doesn't work, we're going to be okay. So we went in very positively. We took a vacation before we started injections. We loved Dr. Lannan. I loved visiting Catherine, and fortunately, it all worked out well.
What advice do you have for others who might be going through something similar to your journey?
Well, what's funny is that I actually went public on my Instagram feed, and when I posted our journey, which was actually kind of post was the start of IVF, so many people reached out to me going through the same thing. There's such a stigma on infertility still, where women are not comfortable sharing their stories. And I've created kind of my own little network in helping people. I have a friend that's starting injections on Friday. And, you know, there's just so many people that should be talking about it but are too scared or ashamed to. So I suggest, when I started talking about it, it made me feel so much better. Finding friends that you can talk to, finding a support system. Catherine, I've always said, is kind of like a therapy session while I get my acupuncture done. It's a journey, but just know, try not to have it affect your marriage or your relationship, and just try to breathe through it all, because it is really, really hard, but you're not the only one going through it, and there are other people out there that can help support you.
Well, Elena, thank you so much for calling in, and we are wishing you well with your pregnancy. That's Elena LeBanc Trident. She's from Kennebunk and currently 5 months pregnant after IVF and acupuncture treatment. So, Elise, when you hear Elena's story, you're nodding.
Yeah. Elena used some, you know, just really amazing words in her story there as she talked about feeling so scared, and she used the word ashamed. She used the word expectation, you know, just really thinking about, you know, the depth of just our personhood that I feel like infertility can start to creep into. And it sounds like she got some amazing support, you know, that her resilience really helped carry her through. And really, the people that I meet in the work that I do are some of the most resilient people I think I've ever met. You know, these are incredibly resourceful families, and yet this stigma and this fear and this shame and this gap between what we expect and what reality looks like just causes a lot of distress.
Why do you think there's stigma? I mean, this is something that's very, very common. I mean, at least 1 in 10, maybe more, women and couples. Why?
I don't know. One of the things that I see is, you know, the women come to me in my practice, and although I treat men as well that are having reproductive issues, we automatically assume that it's, you know, someone's having difficulty conceiving, and we just automatically as a society assume that it's the woman, it's my fault. Where that ultimately comes from, I mean, that probably goes back years and years and years. But, you know, I try to encourage my patients. I mean, as you discussed, you know, a third of the time it's something going on with a woman, a third of the time it's something going on with a man, and a third of the time it might be something, the combination of between the two.
Part of the reason we're having the program at this point in time is because Michelle Obama came out in her recent memoir and discussed her own struggle. How important is it for somebody who's, you know, really well-known and well-respected to be having this public conversation?
I think it's really it's great to get the publicity, and I think it's really great that Michelle Obama came forward and really put it out again in a spotlight. And, you know, as we were preparing for the show and looking for patients that could call in, it's difficult to find somebody who's willing to just go public as Elena did. And I think it's it's great to, that people are willing to do that. You know, this is a very common medical procedure that we're doing all the time, but if you go back a generation, it wasn't so, and a lot of people compare themselves to their mother on the very first line. You know, my mom was very fertile, and so I wasn't expecting to have a problem. And I think until we really get this out there in, you know, from just an insurance standpoint of what we consider a disease and what's kind of a luxury, you know, we're not going to have people comfortable talking about it.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I want to go to an email. Now I'm not going to be able to find it. Here we go. An email from Regina. Thank you for raising up this issue in today's show. I wonder if you can speak to the way insurance covers, or rather mostly doesn't cover, treatment, and whether there is a state or federal policy change we could enact that would require insurers to offer treatment for infertility. So my understanding is that in some states there is coverage and in others there is not, correct?
Yeah, it's mandated state by state. Any state can it's really ultimately dictated by employers, but in states like Massachusetts, employers are required to offer infertility treatment as a benefit. In Maine, it is up to the employer to do that, and most employers aren't necessarily choosing not to. They just may not be aware that it's a decision. So I would say, if you're an employer out there and you're interested, you can talk to your whoever is you're getting your insurance through and add infertility coverage as a benefit. And many local groups have done that. In Maine, it is as I said, not mandated, and so most people are paying out of pocket for this, and it can be very expensive. And part of the reason people don't seek treatment. So there are legislative actions that can happen. And there's a process in New Hampshire right now where they're trying to get a mandate through as well. But it's a tricky thing in a time where people are concerned about, you know, budgets and where we're spending our money. And, you know, it's difficult to add anything. So
interestingly, I have clinics in both Maine and New Hampshire. And there's a lot of acupuncture benefits in the state of Maine currently. In New Hampshire, not so much. But there are five different insurance companies that I work with in Maine that do cover acupuncture.
Are they the more common insurance companies that many people have?
Yeah. Anthem, Harvard Pilgrim, Aetna, Cigna, United Healthcare.
Well, I frankly think that the lack of insurance coverage, you know, also adds to the stigma component of things, because it becomes that some fertility treatments are presumed to be accessible only to those who are socioeconomically able to access them. And so then I think some of the patients that I talk with are saying, you know, that they feel negatively judged, that they would choose to spend their money on something like fertility treatments. You know, this phenomenon of all the misunderstandings and designer babies and all of this sort of stuff just starts to really bubble up and add to this feeling of being in a negative spotlight if you opt in for these treatments. So I think insurance coverage is a really critical issue. And I know that there are advocacy groups, you know, nationally that are working in their respective states to try and pave more ways for all to have access to care.
We have an email from Aaron. My husband and I tried to have a baby unsuccessfully for 5 years. When I finally did get pregnant, we lost that baby, and the next and the next. The process was absolutely heartbreaking, and it shook me to my core as a human. I felt like I wasn't a woman because I couldn't carry a baby. One of the most hurtful parts of the process were comments from my family and friends. When are you going to have a baby? What's taking so long? So, are you going to try again? These seem innocent enough, but struggling with getting pregnant was such a deeply painful experience that I resented those comments. I'm not sure everyone understands how deeply this issue affects the woman and couple who are desperately trying to create a family. In the end, I was very lucky. I did end up getting pregnant naturally, having a successful pregnancy, and now have a beautiful little girl. But I will never forget the despair I felt going through this process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, despair. I mean, I think that's such a good summarizing word for what a lot of people feel. This shakes you. You think you know yourself, and you think you know where your lines are in terms of what you would do. And for a lot of people, their line moves in this process. Well, I'm just going to do IUI. Well, no, now I'm just going to do IVF. And it moves, and I think that that really can feel upheaving.
You know, one of the things that I always say to my patients is, it's okay to set some boundaries with your family and your friends. And one of those is just let them know early on, especially if you've already told them what's happening, is that this is not a safe subject unless I bring it up. That means I only want to talk about it if I'm at, you know, that point in time ready to talk about it. And that's really helped a lot of my patients.
I think that's a great idea.
Okay, we'll go to Margaret, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Margaret, go ahead.
Hi there. So it is still 15 years later an emotional subject for me. First of all, I want to encourage people to join support groups, not only for the support, but everybody brings great information to, which doctors they've had success with and which fertility programs. But also, I had had three miscarriages, and my FSH was high, and I was clearly headed toward early menopause. So, emotional. Anyway, I went through a program that resolved it. I don't know whether you guys have talked about Resolve at all. This was in Massachusetts. I'm not sure how active Resolve is in Maine. But my husband, who comes from a very science-oriented family, was really gung-ho donor egg. And I was wondering, about adoption versus donor egg and really needed time and hand-holding to see if I would be on board with donor egg. And Resolve had this great program. I don't remember. It might have even been 6 months long where we were driving to Boston once a week to meet with other couples. There might have been, 12 other couples or, a bunch of other couples. And a woman who led it, who had gone through adoption herself, but was inviting people in, experts, lawyers, and parents who had succeeded to have kids through donor egg. And the issues they came up with, I mean, some parents some mothers really doubted their true maternalness. They felt like they weren't sure if they were the real mother. I didn't feel like that was going to be my issue.
Margaret,
I'm
so glad you called in, and we have not discussed that yet on the program. So Resolve is a program. Why don't you, Dr. Lana, why don't you explain to
Resolve,
us what it is?
Resolve, Margaret, thank you so much for calling. And I think just, hearing in the voice 15 years on how this has still impacted somebody, it's, you cannot underestimate the impact on someone's whole life for this stuff. But Resolve is a national support group that there is a chapter here in Maine, and there's a group in New England that runs support groups. And so for individuals or couples who are looking for group-based support, there are groups you can go through the Resolve website and find them.
And is this only for people who are choosing a donor egg or for people who are choosing all sorts of options?
There's a variety. There's groups on recurrent miscarriage. There's groups on just general infertility. And within that, people who are having to make decisions about using egg donors and everything. So each group, depending on the year, may have more or less people in it, but there are generally groups geared towards different issues within the specialty.
And Margaret, I apologize to cut you off. Would you like to share with us what happened, what you decided?
Well, we went through two cycles of donor egg, and the second cycle was successful, and we have a son. So that is a great outcome. I did want to also mention something that is lesser known. I happen to be a bit of an artist, and at the time that I was going through my miscarriages, there was a show that was being curated in Northampton, Mass., which has now become international. It's called The Secret Club, and there was actually a book that was created by the curator called Grief Unseen. So I was a part of an exhibit of art by women who had miscarriages. And so that's something people can look up online. And that was, it was great. People were coming out of the woodwork to come to the show because it is such an isolating experience.
Margaret, thank you so much for calling. Our producer put a note that he has put a link to resolve.org on our Facebook page and on our website. So thank you. We'll move on and go to Beth, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Beth. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Lannan, and hi, Elise. This is Beth. Dr. Lannan gave me two children. I now have a 3-year-old and a 3-month-old baby girl. The baby girl was of the embryos from the cycle that produced our son. And so they are from the same batch of embryos, and they're very sweet and very close. My husband and I came to Dr. Landon after a year of trying to conceive, very frustrated and already really raw and vulnerable. And we had a struggle. We had a really hard time at first, and it was about halfway through our journey that I started seeing Elise. And I just want to speak to how important I think it is to reach out and get help in whatever form you can for the emotional component, because of that rawness and vulnerability and sort of mixed experience with expectation that you all have touched on. I just can't say how important that is enough.
How lovely to hear from you, Beth. And thank you. You know, thank you for the vouching for what emotional support can do. You know, I appreciate that you're leaving open that sort of whatever forum feels best. There's really no one right way to do it. I think that I think counseling can sometimes just offer that kind of protected spot where you're not leaning on family for more than you want to lean on them for, or more than they're going to be able to sort of lean in with you on. And so I think there is something very special about what it can offer. And I'm so glad to hear from you.
Beth, thank you for your call. We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Local 188, Spanish cuisine, fine cocktails, and local art since 1999, in Portland's West End and at local188.com.
Martin Luther King Jr. came to embody the ideal of peaceful, nonviolent protest. So how did he handle his anger?
He came very dangerously close at that particular time to hating all white people.
I'm Ari Shapiro, turning anger into positive action. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. And coming up at 2, World Affairs, The Price of Journalism, Jason Rezaian's 544 Days in an Iranian Prison.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, dealing with infertility. Joining us today, Elise Corbett, who is a psychologist with Bella Vita Counseling. Ben Lannan, a reproductive endocrinologist at Boston IVF. And Catherine Alexander Anderson, doctor of acupuncture and Chinese medicine with Rhythms. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. An email from Heidi. Does using birth control for long periods of time increase the risk of infertility when a woman stops birth control and wants to get pregnant?
I'll say just no on that. I think we've had a long use of birth control, and there does not seem to be a significant impact to people using it. So don't worry about it.
An email from Maggie. Are multiple miscarriages a sign of infertility?
That's a really interesting question. There are some people that have trouble getting pregnant, and then when they do get pregnant, have trouble staying pregnant. And then there are other people who get pregnant very easily but have trouble keeping them. So sometimes they are linked by certain conditions, and sometimes it's just sort of separate bad luck. But part of our initial evaluation, so sometimes we see people who are in that group of people who don't have a hard time getting pregnant but are having trouble staying pregnant. And you know, my ultimate goal is healthy pregnancies and children for people. And so whether it is not getting pregnant or not staying pregnant, we kind of deal with both issues.
We'll go to Sarah calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to say that I am an IVF child, and I have two older sisters who were IVF before me. And then I was frozen for 3 years in Texas. And I just recently found out, I'm a freshman in college, I found out my junior year in high school, and it was really bizarre to find out, but cool.
Wow. And how'd you find out? Did your folks tell you?
Yeah, they did. It was great.
It's an interesting, thanks for calling. It's an interesting point that, you know, some of our patients and couples wonder how they're going to tell their children about this someday, you know, whether they're conceived through IVF or through egg donation. And, you know, as in my own life, if I say, well, my kids, I have to explain to them where they came from, and it's equally confusing to them. So, but it is a an interesting dilemma that comes up for some people of, you know, how are we going to talk about this? So it's nice to hear a perspective from somebody who's gone through it.
Sarah, thanks for your call. An email from Wendy. Hi, I'm emailing rather than calling in because this is a painful topic and it's easier this way. Two things. First, we live in a society that venerates motherhood and worships children to a ridiculous extent. If you're not mother, you're other. This is not a fun way to live for those of us who deal daily with the pain of infertility. So a little kindness goes a long way. If you've been blessed, don't assume you know why others don't have children. Second, I'd like to let other infertile women know about a great book on this subject. Quote, Living the Life Unexpected, 12 Weeks to Your Plan B for a Meaningful and Fulfilling Future Without Children by Jody Day. I found it very healing. And this is related to what you were talking about, isn't it? How you want couples to talk about if they'll be okay if it doesn't work out.
Yeah, I think that's a really important topic. And, you know, it kind of hit home when Margaret was talking earlier, because I got into, for many, many years professionally, I was in Western medicine, and I came to Chinese medicine through infertility. So I, you know, after whatever, long story, but, you know, I ultimately did not end up having children. So through something so tragic in my own life, you know, I came to helping others with infertility. And so I always tell my patients that, you know, I am a mother. I'm a mother to my border collie. I'm a mother to the planet Earth. I'm a mother to my patients. And there are other fulfilling ways in life to be a mother besides just biologically giving birth to a child.
We'll go to Daniel, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Daniel. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to invite your listeners not to consider adoption as a secondary or a lesser route to being a parent. The planet has too many people. Your genes are overrated, and there's a shortage of foster and adoptive parents in this state. And it was the best decision I ever made in my life. My daughters are beautiful, and they're the best thing that ever happened. So I think people often think of it as something as a this is my plan B. This is what I'm going to do, and they don't really fully explore it until they've gone through a roller coaster, and it may have different challenges, but it's the same as being any other parent.
Daniel, thanks for your call. And we have an email that's similar. This is from John. Convinced that we would not qualify as adoptive parents, we both had modest incomes. My wife and I underwent 10 months of fertility treatment before deciding to look into adopting. I'll never forget our doctor dismissing the idea of adopting and tell us we would never conceive without his intervention. We did go on to adopt internationally. And 1 year to the day after returning from Peru with our daughter, my wife gave birth to our second daughter with no medical intervention. Almost three decades later, I can say that it is love, not biology, that makes a family. And I love both of my children with unbounded depth.
Yeah, those are really great points. And often I try to have those conversations early with our patients to say, you know, what are the options that you would consider acceptable? And, you know, fostering, adoption, all of those things, you know, are not without their own, you know, cost and stress and emotional roller coasters as well. But for many people, are fulfilling, and we definitely don't talk about them as, you know, secondary choices. But just for some couples, it may not be their immediate choice, but whether it's something that's on the table is important to know.
I'm wondering if there are any myths about infertility that people. Riding horses, going in saunas or jacuzzis. I'm guessing these are myths. Am I right?
Yeah, I would say most things that people think help. There's plenty of myths on how you can get pregnant, and also quite a few of things that people think are preventing. But when we look at the science, most of them don't bear out. And again, if you look at our population as a whole, humans do not have a hard time getting pregnant and reproducing. So it's a very small percentage of the population that we're talking about here. But yeah, I think dispelling some of that mythology is one of the other things that we do initially with people, just to kind of, again, avoid people feeling like they have too much control or things that they're doing wrong that are preventing them from getting pregnant.
An email from Jennifer. When I was in my late 20s, after many frustrating months of not getting pregnant, a friend recommended working with a local chiropractor. Within a month, I could feel a difference, and 3 months later, I was pregnant. I was skeptical at first, but am glad I took this path. Catherine, are you thinking that this is somebody getting their body in good shape?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, I work with a lot of chiropractic doctors as well, and, you know, I can't speak for them, but, you know, I think it's just, you know, sort of getting everything back realigned, whether that's, you know, sending impulses through the central nervous system. But yeah, I would say basically, you know, that worked for that particular person.
We have an email from Mark, and gosh, I wish there were a way to connect him with our caller from Bar Harbor, because he says, my wife and I have two wonderful girls via IVF at Boston IVF 20 and 17 years ago. Thank you for all your support. How do we explain to our daughters when they have trouble conceiving? How do we explain that to our daughters when they have trouble conceiving? So kind of a short question, but has a couple layers here. Will the daughters have trouble conceiving? Is there any evidence that just because their parents did, they will?
So, yeah, there has not been any genetic link established for these things. So most of them are unique. And as I said, many people come in saying, oh, well, you know, my mom had five children, so I assumed I would be very fertile. And just as that is not connected, you know, a mother having trouble getting pregnant will not necessarily translate to the daughter. We only have about 40 years worth of children born through IVF, so we don't have that many sort of second and third generation children at this point. But so far, there hasn't been any link. So,
Elise, what kind of guidance do you have for these parents? For it sounds like they haven't told their kids yet how they were conceived, and when they decide to do so, is there any kind of roadmap for them?
Yeah, there is, and you know, and we're trying to, you know, listen to people as they become adults who were conceived through IVF, like Sarah, and hear from them, you know, what's worked and what hasn't worked, and disclosure and how that's gone with their families. But I mean, ultimately, the stories are quite beautiful. I mean, the stories of disclosure around IVF or donor-conceived children is, we wanted you. We wanted you so much, and much like adoption too. You know, you were very wanted, and typically these stories, you know, really warm a child's heart. All children want to feel wanted, and so while they came to have their family by whatever means they did, I think children tend to feel some pride in the story of how they came to be, whether they're told that at a young age or whether they're told that when they get older.
We'll go to Rosemarie calling from South Portland. Hi, Rosemarie. Go ahead.
Hi there. A couple people have touched on this, but I wanted to sort of start with saying, so first, I'm very socially liberal and I'm pro-choice and a strong feminist. So,
Rosemarie, are you far away from your phone? I'm having a hard time hearing you.
No, but I can come up closer.
Oh, that's better. Go ahead.
Okay. So I was just saying, I'm socially liberal and I'm pro-choice. I'm a strong feminist, and I miscarried at 39, 6 months before being diagnosed with breast cancer, and I felt like that was my body taking care of itself. You know, that I was not really going to be able to sustain that pregnancy and go through chemotherapy and the treatment I would need to go through. And subsequently, never had any biological children. And I adopted a young man from Rwanda as an adult, when he was an adult, actually. But so I'm just wondering what we're doing in society about how much value we put on couples having their biological children. And some people talked about adoption and just the idea that there's so many children out there without families. And do we make that okay? Yes, my last point is just about insurance. I hear people calling this a disease, but it's certainly not, you know, it's not technically a health risk. So should insurance cover it? Because everybody's rates are affected. So do I want everybody's rates to be affected by procedures that are not really where somebody is not really at a health risk.
Sure, Rosemary. And, you know, you've brought up a point. I'm going to move along because we're getting toward the end of the program that hasn't been brought up, which is the World Health Organization and now the AMA are endorsing calling infertility disease. And my understanding, it is just what Rosemary has said, in order to get insurance companies to recognize it. Does anybody in this room have thoughts about calling infertility a disease and the pros and cons of that?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at what the definition of a disease is, and I don't want to take the rest of the show to go through dictionary definitions, but infertility qualifies just like many other things. And I think if you look at the comorbid conditions like depression, anxiety, a lot of things that people go through in an attempt to try to get pregnant, you know, we're already paying for all of these things, whether we want to or not. And so giving people the tools that are actually effective is a better use of resources for a very small number of people. And again, if we start judging people's lifestyles and what we're willing to pay for, then, you know, there are lots of other health conditions that we should all stop doing that would significantly reduce all of our healthcare costs.
Rosemary, thanks for your call and your perspective. An email from Michelle. I'm also a patient of Dr. Lannan's. I am currently in the trenches of IVF treatment. We are gearing up for our second transfer after the first one failed. It's important to point out the huge supportive community within Instagram, where women can connect and lift each other up during this roller coaster of a journey. This can be a very isolating experience, but it doesn't have to be. You can either use your personal account or create a new one for privacy and search hashtags related to infertility. You will uncover an amazingly loving community that is there to support you. My heart is with all of the listeners who are struggling with infertility. So an example of where social media is being used for good.
Yeah, I see social media being used for good a lot with the patients that I see. And similarly, though, I think it depends on the social media and what kind of boundaries and privacy notifications you can set, because it can be one of those things where you can't always control your stimuli. And so something that might feel good, depending where you are in your journey, could feel triggering at another point. And so I really think it's just a matter of knowing yourself and knowing, you know, what's going to work for you. There's a lot of validation and a lot of good information to be had via social media. And I think it's also a space that's fettered with other people's pregnancy announcements.
Oh, yeah.
And that can
that's
be really hard.
Point.
Yeah.
That's going to be our last word. Thank you all for being here. I just looked at the clock. Dr. Ben Lannan, reproductive endocrinologist at Boston IVF and a clinical instructor at Maine Medical Center. Catherine Alexander Anderson, doctor of acupuncture and Chinese medicine and founder and clinical director of Rhythms, offering reproductive care. And Elise Corbett, a licensed psychologist with Bella Vita Counseling in Portland, specializing in reproductive health psychology. Lucy Suchek ran the board. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.